There's sports betting, and then there's Circa Las Vegas, an adults-only sports watching nirvana. Now you can watch up to 19 games at the world's largest sports book on a 78-million-pixel, three-story mega screen. Plus, it's always spectator season at America's largest pool amphitheater, Stadium Swim. Stadium Swim is open 365 days a year and features all sports on an epic 143-foot screen. Book your reservation at CircaLasVegas.com. Circa Las Vegas, this is sports the way it should be.
I was waiting for the special music, but I've been informed that Michael Heck is on double secret probation for arriving late to the interview today and wasn't able to put his own production flair and touch at the beginning of today's show. And I apologize on his behalf, folks.
And so Michael, peace welcome. And happiness prevailed in the kingdom.
So what's going on, Michael? I understand that you're out there in Avondale.
Yes, I'm out here in beautiful Avondale by the Patrick Taylor High School. Actually, just coming out of a press conference that I think our special guest is going to talk to us about a new food and beverage incubator that JEDCO is going to be starting out here. So I don't want to steal Lacey Bordelon's thunder, but a great announcement. Senator Bill Cassidy was out here. A lot of the parish council was out here as well. Senator Patrick Connick. A nice day, and it's just exciting to see what's happening out here at Avondale. I remember when it was just an idea on a board from Big Lou Gunter, and now it's really beginning to fill in. There's going to be new ballparks, new housing. Delgado is out here. It's exciting to see it slowly emerge into view.
Absolutely. A lot of good things happening in that area. Michael, since you and I talked last, we are getting closer and closer to the trifecta of days of Taylor Swift. Where do we stand on some of the improvements around the dome?
Yeah, so we are about 130 days from the actual, from the big event. Taylor Swift, the three nights, we're going to use them as a dry run. We're pretty much done around the dome. There's some patchwork they're still doing on the exterior lanes of Poydras. They are actually, and this is really exciting to me, maybe nobody else, they have begun work on my personal pothole, which is remember we called it the archipelago, which is at the entrance to I-10 at Claiborne to Poydras, and they waited until the Saints were away for 2 weeks to get to work on that, and I don't know. It's kind of bittersweet. You know how sometimes, in the movies, when the good guy finally kills the villain, and he's kind of sad because he's lost his purpose. I don't know what I'm going to do when that pothole goes away. I'm gonna.
Hey, I promise you, I'll find you another.
Okay. Did I tell you the other day that
we should have an hasta la vista party for DJ El Camino right there at the pothole
once in this place there was a pothole. But the big article that came out in the paper last week, which I actually appreciated, was about Frenchman Street. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that Frenchman Street, to some degree, has become a victim of its own success, which is kind of inevitable and maybe the way places develop. But then, in some other ways, it's just been neglected. There are uses going on there which are not legal. The street is tore up. There's too much congestion. There's illicit activity. And so the question that I was asked is, are we looking at Frenchman Street in that area for the Super Bowl? And the answer is yes. We're going to be doing some roadwork repairs. From Decatur down to Washington Square. The city just started last week a rideshare pilot program where at this point, Uber and Lyft are going to drop people off outside of Frenchman Street. And then you're going to have to walk in. So you're going to walk in from Elysian Fields instead of that kind of lineup that happens outside the Spotted Cat in DBA.
Right.
And then we're working on some specific things, particularly that one building, which has been kind of left there, being propped up by a bunch of 2x4s. We have to figure out how we can at least beautify that and make it kind of less of an eyesore. for the game. So yeah, we've been walking Frenchman Street, and it is part of the plan because from our perspective, it effectively is part of the French Quarter tourist experience.
Michael, I think I told this story several months ago. We were there on a Monday night, went to listen to Trumpet Mafia play. Mm-hmm. And it was, we walked out of there. The street was packed. It was a Monday night. I mean, it felt like Mardi Gras. And it was really refreshing. I mean, it was just everybody was having a good time, interacting. You know, we bumped into some folks and we're just talking and this and that. And you know, and I was just looking around. I said, man, this. And same observation, we're not paying a lot of attention to it, and we need to, because it's another little pocket that's really kind of very important to the culture of the city and what we have to offer with live music. There's a collection of you know, places there, Snug Harbor, Spotted Cat, and the like. Used to go to Snug Harbor at least once a week when I was single. I loved that place. Listen to Wanda Ruzan, and I mean the list just goes on and on and on. I think you're right. I think we're kind of missed the target over there, and it'd be nice to hone in on it and get it cleaned up.
Just pull it back a little bit. I mean, it just needs a little bit of TLC, and I think at its best, Frenchman Street, at least to me, represents kind of what the French Quarter should be. It's fun. Mm-hmm. It's celebratory. It's got a little edge to it, but there's a quality there to the music, to the restaurants, to the bars. It's not tawdry. It's not dangerous. It's a place you can go and experience, the world-class musicians and other cultures of the world. I mean, look, Snug Harbor, I put that up against any jazz club in the world for the quality of the acts they have in there, and even just the acoustics. I mean, you can sit there and have a drink, and it's, there's no bad seat in the house. So, yeah, so it's personal to me as well. We're going to, we're going to clean up Frenchman Street along with everything else that's beginning to happen in the French Quarter in general.
So the rideshare idea, I think, is a great idea. And I also think it's a great idea to think about that in other places in the city where there's a destination where you go for pickup and drop off, right? And you restrict it to that area, you remove some of that traffic off, and it actually opens up different areas for other development in that area as well.
It does. We're going to be doing it for the Super Bowl. We're going to have park and ride areas in places like Metairie, the West Bank, New Orleans East, so people don't have to drive in. They'll be able to park and take public transport in. But in general, Newell, you're right. Taking cars off the road increases pedestrian traffic. It increases sales. It's a healthier environment. And it's kind of goes through these typical phases that when you propose, people push back and say, you can't do that. You're going to shut down commerce, shut down deliveries. But the best example I have of this is, as you know, my wife is Danish, and the main shopping thoroughfare in Copenhagen is a street called Strøget. And when the mayor in the 70s proposed to pedestrianize it, he literally had death threats made against him. And, like, that's not a very Danish thing. Like, they usually keep it in the pocket. Like, you know, they'll kill you by putting you on an iceberg and pushing you out to sea while you're sleeping. But, like, they won't act, you know. But now Strøget is the longest and most popular, most successful shopping street in all of Europe. And so these ideas about doing things to allow people on foot to enjoy an area without having to be congested or worry about safety because of vehicles is something we should think about, I think, in our high-density tourist areas, the French Quarter and Frenchman Street, first and foremost.
Absolutely. The other day, the governor announces a sweeping overhaul of Louisiana tax system. A lot of the details yet to be provided. Your thoughts?
what you have to say about this governor, regardless of what you feel about what he is doing, he ain't scared. He is going for it and taking these issues by the throat and is being bold. And I think what the governor, you know, is saying is, look, y'all, Louisiana has been falling behind while the rest of the South over the past 10 years gained 3.5 million in population, and we lost 40,000. If you look at Texas and Louisiana in terms of, you know, the things that matter, Newell, economic output, population, unfortunately, you have a South Korea-North Korea comparison. You can see it from space. And I think what he said is that although the politically safe thing to do is to try to incrementally get better, and look, we've been pushing that at GNO Inc. I mean, we pushed to get the top income tax rate down from 6 to 4.25. I think he's saying it's not enough. We have to throw over the table. We have to shoot the moon. We have to throw the head, whatever it is, because the future of the state depends on it. Well, that's effectively what he is proposing here. Some parts about it, just to kind of talk about the highlights. It would take the personal income tax rate, which currently is at 6.25, and that would collapse into a flat tax at 3%. It would take the corporate tax rate, which is currently tops out at 7.5, and collapse that into a flat rate of 3.5. And then the pay for this is, first and foremost, that extra 0.45 of sales tax is going to stay on. I always thought it would stay on because it's just the easiest thing to do. I can't see it any other way. But the breaks for things like groceries and medicine would still remain. They would still remain untaxed. But then there are going to be a lot of tax breaks that are eliminated as well, from stuff that are basic, like quality jobs, to stuff that is more specific, like entertainment incentives. And that's going to be a big discussion. So it's a bold plan. Also, sales tax will be broadened, I'm sorry, to include some things that are not currently taxed, like lobbying and, I don't know, dog care. There's some very strange things that are currently not subject to sales tax. So it's a bold plan. It's going to be very it's going to stir a lot of emotion, I think, on both sides. But I give the governor credit for, you know, recognizing the magnitude of the challenge. 100 years of flawed policy piled on top of each other, and he's saying we're going to rip the Band-Aid off. A lot of mixed metaphors here, Newell, but
I guess one of my concerns is when we look at other states that have gone down this avenue, and this is out of ignorance, I don't know the answer. Did they choose the sales tax route to increase sales taxes, increase the transactions, certain transactions that are going to be taxable, to make up the difference to get to a lower tax rate? My gut tells me I don't believe that that's in fact the case, because we have one of the highest sales tax rates right now before any of this is modified in the country. And transferring that burden in that fashion in order to get to a 3% flat tax rate seems a little onerous to me. And it's going to be interesting to see the dynamic between state and local sales taxes. So, for example, some localities actually tax prescriptions. The state's right. going to step in and not allow them to do that. Well, what's going to be interesting about that is, how are they going to empower local government to make up that difference in those localities? And with the additional services to be taxed, will local government be able to tax those additional services, or will they be carved out to just the state? So, for example, the state collects a sales tax on telecommunications. Local government is not allowed to do so. So it's going to be interesting, this tug of war, as it relates to that. I was thinking that they were going to go more down the elimination of sales tax exemptions as opposed to what I heard the other day. And it may be the case that they are going to do that. I don't know. But they didn't talk about that a lot. And there are a lot of those details that need to be flushed out.
Yeah, so let me. You're actually bringing up a really, really important point. So one is that, yeah, they're going to be eliminating some exemptions like landscaping and car washing and dog grooming. So in that sense, they're going to broaden the sales tax base, which is considered good policy, right? And a lot of states have done that. But the critical difference between us and Texas, and you're right about this, is the way Texas achieves actually zero personal income tax is that they have double the property tax that we have in Louisiana, right? So that's how they do it, because the per capita tax rate in Texas versus Louisiana is very similar, within about a few hundred bucks. But what they said is we're going to have high property taxes, which frankly are better taxes because they go to schools, they go to public safety, they go to roads, they're locally controlled. Now in Louisiana, where we are very used to having relatively low property taxes and have a homestead exemption, it's considered a political third rail to try to go after that, because effectively we would be asking the parishes, the parish presidents and councils, to explain to their constituents why they're going to have to double their property tax, and good luck with that. So the route that this is going is, one, we're not going to be able to get to zero, first of all. But second, we're going to do it through, you know, relying more on sales tax, as you said, than almost any other state in the country, which would be considered totally regressive, except for the fact that we do have the exemptions for food and medicine and so forth, and gasoline. So, yeah, it is. It's not the way you would necessarily draw this up if you were creating the 51st state in the country, right? The Kingdom of Newell. But this is a big change, nonetheless.
Do you know, Michael? I mean, I know that the income tax phases out at a number. It's $100,000+ of income. I don't remember what that number is. Have they talked about whether that number goes up or stays the same or what?
I don't know the answer to that one, Newell. I got to find that out, but I'll find out and let you know, let people know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Michael Heck, president and CEO of GNO Inc. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us.
America's favorite place to watch football is Stadium Swim, located at Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Catch all the biggest games at a viewing experience built for sports fans. Chill in one of their six pools on three different levels for a perfect view of their massive screen. Plenty of seating options, from cozy day beds to private, temperature-controlled cabanas. Stadium Swim. Book your spot today at CircaLasVegas.com.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Michael Heck, president and CEO of GNO Inc. Michael, an exciting announcement relative to the Lafitte Greenway. That's been a huge success and a revitalization of just like the heart of the city. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I really love the story. So, you know, the Lafitte Greenway has become an amenity. It's become a way for people to get from mid-city and Bayou St. John into downtown. And now there is a new plan that the Lafitte Greenway Partnership has where they're going to be extending it. It's going to be going up further back towards the lake now. And I'm just really excited about that, because it's one of those things that when it's talked about, you're like, okay, that would be a nice thing to do. But once you start experiencing it, and understanding how it becomes a part of your life, and it connects you to hospitals and neighborhoods, helps with drainage, you wonder what you did without it. So now it's going to go, I think, about a half mile further from the beginning, and then connect all the way down into Canal Boulevard.
Yeah, that's going to be huge. And these projects, they said they're expected to be completed by December 2026. That's a pretty aggressive timeline.
Yeah. But, you know, it's with all these projects, as we're seeing, you know, with the Super Bowl stuff, if you set a deadline, you have some urgency, you actually can get it done. I mean, mm-hmm. if we were China, we'd have it done next month. So yeah. It's really a question of, I mean, not that we should be, because then, you know, but it's a question of political will. So I think that they're going to be able to make that deadline.
Absolutely. Michael, we have a special guest.
Yeah, well, this is, I was just with Lacey. Lacey Bordelon, the VP and Chief Operating Officer at JEDCO, and she's here to talk about the announcement that we just made about a new food incubator that's going to be breaking ground tomorrow in this rapidly growing Churchill Business and Industrial Park here over in Avondale Fairfield. So it's great to have Lacey on the show to tell us all about it.
Folks, Lacey Bordelon, VP and COO of JEDCO, joins us. Lacey, welcome to the show.
Oh, great. Hi, Noel and Michael. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
So a $4.2 million grant, I guess, for the design, engineering, and construction of a food and beverage incubator. Tell us about it.
Right. Oh, this is so exciting for Jefferson Parish and our whole region. Some folks might be familiar with Edible Enterprises, which was the only food incubator in our region in St. Charles Parish. It experienced complete devastation with Hurricane Ida and is now permanently closed. And, you know, very quickly we learned how much demand there is for such a facility that provides kitchen equipment, all the appliances needed for food production, as well as space, storage space, loading space, cold storage space. This is a critical need in our region of our small businesses and entrepreneurs in the food and beverage industry. You know, we were helping these businesses that were in tenants of Edible Enterprises to try to find shared space or space they could share with an existing food establishment. And I think we were successful in pairing up a couple of them, but unfortunately there are many that just couldn't continue their operations, which is very sad. So we're thrilled to be able to provide this resource to our food and beverage startups here in our region.
So the project breaks down with a number of funding sources. Tell us about those.
Sure, yes. Well, we were fortunate to receive a $2 million grant from the United States Economic Development Administration, EDA. And then our local match requirement is being met from multiple entities, and that includes the Jefferson Parish Council, who have committed $1.5 million, $500,000 from Louisiana Economic Development, our state partner, and then $200,000 from JEDCO Development Corporation, which is JEDCO's lending arm.
And you guys, JEDCO, will be managing the project, is that right?
Yes, we sure will, and so happy to report that we have added to our team a tried and true veteran of the food and beverage industry, Diane Scofani, who some listeners might remember, the Scofani restaurant. She grew up in that environment. She's a chef, and she spent the last several years providing technical assistance to these businesses, you know, preparing them for asking going to a lender and explaining the licensing requirements and coaching them. So we're so fortunate to have her on our team now, and she will be spearheading this project moving forward.
If you would, Lacey, connect the dots for folks why this is so important. One of the things that that is obvious to me is that it's important when a startup starts that they actually stay going, right? I mean, because you have these disruptions and they're renting space, and you know, then you have to backfill it with others. But if you can get them off to a great start from the very beginning, it seems to me that the likelihood of success goes up exponentially, right?
You're right. And you know, standing up a business in the food industry is very difficult. There's so many various requirements, USDA requirements, licensing, et cetera. So, you know, this is important because we're providing the kitchen equipment and appliances there. That's an expensive project for any food and beverage business, especially for a startup. So, you know, by providing them that those resources and then on top of that, the technical support, which is desperately needed, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs in this industry don't know. They make a good product, right? A great Cajun mac and cheese, but they just don't necessarily know how to move that forward. So, and we'll be able to provide that guidance and coaching in this for this project.
Yeah, if I just jump in for 1 second as a survivor of the food and beverage industry, I was just out at the 25th anniversary of our first restaurant last week. I can say that what's so critical about this incubator and projects like this in general is that it's so risky going into the food and beverage industry because it's so competitive and because so many costs are high and out of your control, that really what this incubator is doing is it's de-risking the business for smaller businesses and entrepreneurs. And that de-risking, to your point, Newell, makes it much more likely that they're going to survive. It's just that usually we talk about like supporting or helping. I think it's actually kind of the same thing, but it looked at it in a different perspective. It's taking out some of the risks. That's really why this is so important.
And when you look, Lacey, at the food and beverage industry impact, you guys have it broken down. And as I was looking at these numbers, I mean, it's a hell of a lot stronger than I ever thought. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Right. So this project, or really the food and beverage and culinary related businesses, make up a $1 billion industry in the greater New Orleans area. They create nearly 7,000 jobs in our region, and generate over almost $580 million in earnings. With this incubator, we can open this incubator with 35 tenants. We know, we've talked to them, there's a need, but really it's expected to generate about 55 new construction engineering jobs and retaining 420 food and beverage industry-related jobs in the region. The project is expected to bring in more than $66.2 million in private investment. This is a big deal for JEDCO, for Jefferson Parish, and for our region, as you can see.
Yeah, and, you know, the food and beverage industry here has played such a critical part in the growth of our economy, too, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all know that the New Orleans area is known for our fine cuisine. And, you know, we have so much talent in that regard locally. But like, as Michael said, there's competition. It's extremely expensive. So we feel like we will be helping them, like Michael said, really de-risking the business for them. And that's something we're super excited to do.
While I have you on, Lacey, and I don't know if you know about the Brownfield Assessment Grant that you guys receive, $600,000. If you do, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So, yes, we were able to receive that grant from the EPA. It does Phase 1 and Phase 2 environmental assessments. And this is all about repositioning those brownfield properties, which either, you know, as a brownfield, it either is contaminated and there's known contaminants, or there's a perception that possibly there is contaminants. And oftentimes that Phase 1, at least, environmental assessment is needed before someone, you know, purchases a property. If they're seeking financing, that lender's going to want to have that Phase 1 to know what we're dealing with here. So we've been able to fund several, and I apologize, I don't know, have the number on my head, but several Phase 1s and even Phase 2 and a lot of West Bank and former industrial properties. And the announcement we released just last week was that the EPA is allowing us to expand our focus parish-wide. So now we can cover, we can pay for those environmental assessments for East Bank properties along the river or other, you know, former gas station properties, you name it. So we're really excited about that.
The whole goal is to get these properties back into the stream of commerce, right? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. We're repositioning them for development.
Michael, did you have a comment? I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was on mute. Those are the voices in your head.
funny.
I love you for a reason, my friend. But Lacey, because, you know, as you walk, as you drive around the parish, you'll see these properties that have been for like 10 and 20 years just vacant, yeah. Right? And right. You have this complete inability to put them back into the stream of commerce.
100%. Former Johns Manville property and former Knight Celotex property on the West Bank. We have been, JEDCO, you know, the organization has been marketing those properties for project after project after project for years. Without any bites, and it was all because of that, you know, the knowledge that they could very well be contaminated. And I'm happy to report that there is a buyer for the Johns Manville facility, and it would not be the case if we weren't able to provide this kind of support and cover those the costs of the environmental assessment.
And that's it.
Yeah, we need to have a comment, Noel. This is another. Now you made me feel anxious. This is actually another example of de-risking, right? The Branfield Grant de-risk somebody coming into a property that's got some unknown environmental risk, and it's reducing that because it's providing, you know, insight into that without the expense of the building owner. So you know, that's my theme of the day. Let's de-risk the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Lacey, thank you so much for joining us. Lacey Bordelon, VP and COO of JEDCO. Really exciting news on two fronts. Congratulations on these accomplishments. And can't wait to talk about when some of these properties get back into the stream of commerce, because they would be property taxpayers and, you know, employ
exactly.
people.
Create jobs. Exactly.
Absolutely.
We're excited. We will have many success stories to share in that regard. And thank you again so much for having me and giving me the time to share this exciting news for Jefferson Parish and our region.
Congratulations again. That's Lacey Bordelon, VP and COO at JEDCO. We will be right back with Michael Heck when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Michael Heck, President and CEO of GNO Inc. Michael, there's been a lot of momentum on the riverfront, and for me, as I kind of look at what's going on with this strike of the International Longshoremen's Union, it seems to be, you know, just really horrible timing for us because so many things were just falling into place.
Yeah, well, the timing is obviously intentional. This guy Daggett, who runs them, has been doing this for a long time. He's almost 80 years old. He's kind of like right out of central casting, raspy voice, you know, foul mouth. And he's being pretty audacious. You know, I think that his workers control about 60% of containerized traffic for the country. So he thinks that if he does this right before the election, he can really force the issue and make the Biden administration do something to get this thing resolved. I appreciate the importance of the longshoremen and their work. It's critical, and they should get paid fairly. But I think that he might be overshooting, because one of the lessons that industry took from COVID is how to deal with supply chain disruptions. And I think if he thinks that he can just shut down, you know, the American consumer economy and shut down exports of grain and imports of clothing, I think that I don't know if he wins that in the long run. So I think that they'll get concessions, but I think for everybody's sake, including the ILA, it'll get resolved sooner rather than later. What do you think about this? I'm still trying to figure it out.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, it has to. I mean, it's just interesting to me that we have about, I don't know, 50-some-odd thousand ILA members in the country, and it's almost them against the consumer. Because, again, you know, what gets lost in the translation of this analysis is how the consumer is impacted. And you know as well as I, if as a result of this, transportation goes up and this and that, and we've got products sitting all over the world, not moving, we pay more, right? Because the supply is very limited and the demand is the same. And
that's what happens. Like, if something has to come in by an airplane in the belly of a 747 instead of coming in from, you know, a container, which is the least expensive way, then, yeah, at the end of the day, you, me, everybody else is just going to pay more. Walmart's not going to be able to offer everyday low prices if they can't move containers. So it is actually, in an ironic way, a call for class warfare against the working class, really just for the benefit. And if you read the analysis, not necessarily only of the ILA, but of the legacy of this guy who is leading it, who I think wants to hand over the reins to his son after he retires. So it's a complicated issue. I would be surprised if it goes on for too long, because it's too big for people to just let it,
keep rolling. I'm just always suspicious of allowing that much leverage, over critical infrastructure, right? And supply chain management. When you think about it, that 50 some odd thousand people can disrupt 60% of the goods and service goods that are brought into this country, both imported and exported. That seems to be a huge imbalance to me. Obviously, that was the whole purpose of Taft-Hartley. I mean, that's like saying, all of the police get together next year and they say, on National Police Day, why don't we all go on strike? We're not paid enough. Yeah. We certainly don't make what a longshoreman makes. And, we're risking our life every day. And we just shut down policing in the country. I got to imagine that a president, whether Democrat or Republican, would step in real quick.
And
there's certain activities like that. The average salary is about $82,000 a year.
It's more than that, because that's the base.
That's the base. Right. So, when you're making probably in the top 30% of incomes in the country, and you're asking for a 77% increase over 6 years, 12.8% a year for the next 6 years, I don't know many people. You correct me. You interact with them a lot more than I do. They get 12.8% increases every year for 6 years. I don't know that.
No, only Olivia Dunn. I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
But here's the other part about it that's strange. Is that the rallying cry that they're using is that dock workers are not going to be replaced by automation. And I'm actually to some degree sympathetic to that, because if you really understand what J.D. Vance is saying, and I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with everything he says, but the essence of what he says is that the idea of globalization and automation, and that we're going to outsource American jobs and replace them with machines, is going to benefit everybody, was naive, if not cynical. And so I think that there is something to be said that we want, to keep our people productive, but being a Luddite and say we're not going to use automation, that's clearly not the way that you increase pay and increase wealth is by increasing productivity, and automation has to be a part of that. So
we want to go back to cranes with the nets and pallets. I just don't see it. And then the guarantee that no one will lose their jobs in the face of automation, it doesn't work like that in every other silo of business in this country, right? I mean, there are no guarantees.
It works about as well as price controls for food or for rent.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Heck, as always, we truly appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week, my friend.
No, thank you so much. Enjoy the beautiful October weather.
Yeah, absolutely. It has been great thus far. And hopefully no storms come this way, period. Let's knock on wood somewhere. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Walt Leger, president and CEO of New Orleans & Company. And in the back half of the 12 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Clancy Dubose, political editor and columnist for Gambit and WWL New Orleans political analyst. We will talk about the Randy Farrell indictment and the implication of Mayor Cantrell.
A America's favorite place to watch football is Stadium Swim, located at Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Catch all the biggest games at a viewing experience built for sports fans. Chill in one of their six pools on three different levels for a perfect view of their massive screen. Plenty of seating options from cozy daybeds to private, temperature-controlled cabanas. Stadium Swim. Book your spot today at CircaLasVegas.com.